Welcome to the Steamboat Springs Winter Sports Club Show, presented by Honey Stinger. This is a podcast that will make you want to get outdoors and will give you some great ideas as a sport parent, athlete, or coach. Born in the beautiful mountain town of Steamboat Springs, Colorado, the Winter Sports Club was founded over a century ago and now serves a majority of kids in our community and has produced more Winter Olympians than any other club in North America. There are secrets and great stories to share as we play year-round in these mountains we call home. Our calling is to develop complete athletes on and off the mountain by cultivating a passion for the outdoors and a love of sports at all levels. Stay tuned to hear from Olympians, athletes of all ages, coaches, experts, and people who are doing amazing things to make an impact in our community and in their sport.
Hey everyone, I'm your host, Nicole DeBoom. I'm a former professional triathlete who finally discovered the joys of skiing in my late 40s when I moved to Steamboat Springs with my family. We immediately discovered the Steamboat Springs Winter Sports Club, and it's become a huge part of our lives as my husband, Tim DeBoom, is a ski and bike coach, and my daughter, Wilder, has found happiness, friendship, and joy through skiing, jumping, riding, and more. I am thrilled to bring the positive energy of the Winter Sports Club to people all over the world. Thanks for listening. Now let's get started. Hello, friends, listeners, fans of the show, and snow, it's coming. I am excited to share a special guest with you today. John O'Sullivan is in town talking about the what, how, and why of being a sports parent. John, if you don't already know him, which you should, he's a speaker, he's a podcaster, an athlete, a coach, and truly a movement creator, specifically in regards to his Changing the Game project, which we will be drilling into shortly. He's also the author of a couple best-selling books, including one we should all have. It's called Changing the Game, The Parent's Guide to Raising Happy, High-Performing Athletes and Giving Youth Sports Back to Our Kids. John, thanks for joining me today.
Thank you. I'm so excited to be here in Steamboat.
Oh, what do you love about Steamboat?
I love everything about Steamboat. And I love, you know, I lived a couple decades ago. I used to live in Colorado, and I always loved the fall and the aspens and everything. So I'm here at the tail end of it, but just the changing leaves, and we've had a beautiful week since I've been here, blue skies, and I do feel like Colorado is still home for me because of the couple years I lived here. I really do love Colorado.
Well, Colorado's a big state, but what part did you live in?
I lived in Vail.
Oh my gosh.
I lived in Vail.
Yeah. Yes, these high peaks are just amazing. Yep, but yep. Now you're in Bend, Oregon.
Yeah, but it's also not too shabby. Yeah, I've been there 17 years now. So yeah, that's home for sure. That's where we've raised our kids and everything.
Gosh, I love it. Well, and you know, you were an athlete growing up. You became a coach, probably coach athlete. What do you do as a, you know, 50-ish year old person? Are you still working out and playing on the trails and all that stuff?
Oh, yeah, for sure. So I am I'm a mountain biker by summer. In the winter, I'm a big skier and snowboarder. I do both. And about 3 years ago, I started skate skiing as well, which I love. So that's it. I probably don't do yoga as often as I should. Yeah, I like to play golf. I'm a big fly fisherman, things like that.
Oh,
so I try to do as much as possible. It's one of the reasons I started my own company, so no one could tell me I had to be at work on a powder day.
Oh, I love that. You know, okay, well, maybe we just start out by asking you why you still do it. Like, what's your why behind working out? I see like you started talking about it and it was sort of like you lit up and I was like, oh, he finds a lot of joy in this.
I mean, you just said it. It's joy, right? Like I, you know, and like we use the word working out, right? Like kids don't say, oh, I'm going to go work out. They say, I'm going to go play, right? And I think everything I described, it's playing to me. I'm going to go play in the snow, right? I'm going to go play golf. I'm going to go, you know, ride a mountain bike. I mean, I remember when mountain biking felt like work like a workout, right? And then I got like a nice bike, and then it felt like fun, right? and so all these things. I love being out in the woods in the winter, and I love being out in the woods in the summer. And it's joy to me, and it's this constant reminder of why we shouldn't make sports work to our kids. They don't do sports for work. They do it for joy. They do it for fun. They do it to play. And we have to put, I mean, our mission statement at Change the Game Project is putting a little more play back in playing ball.
Oh my God. Yeah, that's exactly perfect. You know, I think we should talk about this progression of joy through sport. So you hit on it. Kids do sport for the joy of it, because it to them it is play. For some of us, it actually becomes a job.
Yeah.
But even if it doesn't, for many adult athletes, or I don't know when it changes, but it becomes something that we feel we must do, or we must do to a certain level, or shouldn't even be trying it, you know?
Yeah.
So what is this like? And then it feels like it comes back to being joy again.
Yeah.
So what is this like decades long area in the middle of our lives when sport is no longer play, but it hasn't returned yet to joy? Why is that happening?
I think for some people they jump into it, right? Like I've never thought of skiing as work. Right. And, you know, I do a lot of ski touring and stuff too. And even if you're hoofing it up a mountain, it doesn't feel like work. It just feels like fun. And I always think about, like, you know, I hate running, right? I will not go for a run. Running, like, I've always been so jealous of the people who get the runner's high, right? And can just go on this run. It's never done that for me. But, you know, I was a telemark skier for many years, right? And you go out for 8 hours and do 2,000 lunges. That never felt like work. That was just fun. Right. And so, you know, I don't know. But when we ask like children why you play sports, and you ask adults, you know, adults say things like to stay in shape, to lose weight, you know, to this, to that. Like, that's not why kids do it. Right. It's to be with their friends. It's to learn new things. It's and it's, you know, to put a smile on my face. And so I think as adults, we understand, we gravitate towards the things that give us joy for the most part. And I always wish that we could just help our kids do the same, you know?
So if they're doing that at the beginning, when and why does that change for them?
Well, I think it changes because, you know, let's call it the sports industrial complex, has created this situation where, oftentimes the business of sport isn't set up to meet the needs of the child in the sport. Right. And so the commitment and the investment in time and the investment in money and all these things, all of a sudden, you know, it's like, well, you have to do this and you have to do this. And what happens is kids lose ownership, and then they lose the enjoyment, and then they lose the intrinsic motivation just to get better. And then they're out. Right. That's when they walk away. And so, you know, there's not an age, but I mean, sadly, what's happened is the age is getting pushed younger and younger and younger in so many places. And it's what I think is great about like a Steamboat or even a Bend for the most part, is that kids can still grow up and play lots of sports. You know, it's way easier to play 3 high school sports at Steamboat High School than it is if you go to school in Los Angeles. Right.
Well, and why is that? Just because they have to weed kids out because the programs are too big, or
schools are huge, right? So, I mean, there's still only one varsity team, and whether if you have 1,000 kids in your high school or 4,000 kids in your high school, right? So just the odds are not with you. And then a lot of these big cities, right? If you want to be part of the soccer club, you know, you start at 6 or 7, and then if you're not signed up for the year-round program, if you're not hiring the private coach, you're out, right? They'll find someone who will. And so only like really the top athletes get like, you know, they can kind of hang for a while dabbling. But for a lot of kids, like if you dabble, you're out, you know?
Yes, but isn't there some beauty in the ability to dabble?
I think the ability to dabble is, it's actually the true path to expertise, right? It's usually the single sport. You know, I was doing a coach education session last night for all our coaches here at Winter Sports Club, and we talked about this. There's this brand new study out that was a collection, you know, an overview of all these other studies. And what it found was that only 7% of elite junior performers were elite senior performers. 7%, right? So 93% of them who we identified when they were 10 or 11 or 12 as this is the best tennis player, this is the best skier, this is the best soccer player, were out of the system by the time, you know, they were senior athletes. So most people who become Olympians, most people who become professional athletes or even high-level college athletes weren't really identified all that young. A lot of times they come to it a little bit later because they dabble early on.
Right, because if they're identified too young, do we then – have we created a system that burns them out?
We have created a system that burns them out, injures them oftentimes. And what happens is they don't develop the athleticism necessary to sustain a higher training load in their teenage years. And those are the hours that really matter, right? So what happens is you take a 9-year-old and play lots and lots of soccer. Of course, they're going to be a better soccer player than their peers who aren't. But if they don't develop, if they don't have a multi, I don't even call it multi-sport anymore, just a multi-movement childhood, martial arts, yoga, strength and conditioning, jumping on a trampoline, riding your bike, whatever it is, right? A multi-movement childhood develops the whole athlete that then can sustain a training load when they hit puberty and grow. The single sport, especially in one-sided sports like baseball or golf or things like that, you know, they're far more likely to get injured if they've only done one sport. They're far more likely to burn out and quit. And so, yeah, so really we spend a lot of time just trying to give parents the courage to be like, you know what? Like take the long view. Why do we put our kids in sport in the first place? I mean, I love working with Winter Sports Club, and we've worked together now for many, many years. A lot of the coaches come to the coaching conference we run as sort of an onboarding when they start. I've been here a couple times before. And when we, you know, sort of just this whole – there's this approach at Winter Sports Club here about like – we're developing better humans and we're just doing it through skiing or snowboarding or whatever, not we're developing skiers and hoping they become good humans.
Oh my gosh. I think I read this when I was researching you. And I think it's one of your podcast titles. So just FYI, everyone, John's got a podcast. It's amazing. It's called Way of Champions. You've got like 350 episodes.
We're getting there, yeah.
It's like huge. Yeah. You've been doing it for a while.
Yeah.
And a bunch of athletes that I know, and really cool stuff. And there was a title that said, it was something about how I've lost it. You know what, guys? Go listen to his podcast. You're just going to love it. But read the titles and you'll be drawn in and sucked in. I'm sure I'm going to think of this later and I'll toss it back out. But quick note, I will put that in the show notes.
Great.
So people
Perfect.
Can come and follow you. But one of the things is that when kids are young, like you said, they're doing sports for fun, mm-hmm. right? Then parents, as the parents notice that their kid is starting to show some promise, right? We tend to introduce something that is maybe called competitiveness or the desire to win. Mm-hmm. If we didn't introduce that, how would that change sports for the kids and their progression?
There's a great there's a guy named Jay Coakley, who's a sports sociologist at University of Colorado in Colorado Springs. And Jay has this great line. He says, when we ask kids why they play baseball, you know, what are their three favorite things, they say, you know, we love hitting and catching and running, right? And then he says, as soon as the adults come in, what do? They try to find the one kid, the pitcher, who doesn't let anyone else hit, catch, or run, right? And that's sort of the adult values onto youth sport. And so there's this massive fallacy that sport can either be fun or competitive. And it has to be both. And I mean, one of our podcasts is, we've done a couple interviews with Steve Kerr from Golden State Warriors. And the number one value of the Golden State Warriors is joy, right? So they're winning world championships, and on the wall, the most important thing is joy. We get to play a sport for a living. So if the Warriors can embrace joy, your 12-year-old can embrace joy, your 14-year-old. Now, joy doesn't mean it's not hard. Joy doesn't mean that there's not some suffering and some struggle and some failure, right? Joy is not the same thing as pleasure, right? And I always use the analogy, and you know, as a triathlete, maybe you didn't experience this, but I've run one marathon in my life. And I always say to people, mile 20 to 26, is there any pleasure? And everyone's like, no, right? I'm like, but you can still enjoy running, right, without having pleasure in that moment. And so, you know, sport can have moments of that's really hard and there's not a lot of pleasure, but you still go, man, that was great. I'd like to go do that again. When's the next practice, right?
Absolutely. I mean, I'm even like drawing back to my own childhood, and maybe we can take a trip down memory lane for both of us here. And for you, what was your path in sports? Was it joy? And do you remember when it changed to being performance based and like winning and making that the focus instead of having fun?
You know, it's funny. So, you know, I'm 52. I grew up on Long Island. So originally a New Yorker. And I think like all my peers did everything, right? So I played soccer, I played baseball, I played lacrosse. I was a wrestler for many years. Then I decided in eighth grade, I think I'm going to play basketball instead of going wrestling. And
perfect example of dabbling, in eighth grade.
You were able to dabble, right? But by high school, I mean, my first year of high school, I went to this big Catholic high school, and there was 90 kids out for 7 spots on the soccer team. And I got one of the 7. And I was like, whew, I don't know if I can play baseball anymore, right? Like that was my moment when I was like, but soccer is my thing. I like it better than baseball. I don't know that I can do both. So I ran track for a little while, and I went to – I mean, my high school was, you know, like my high school soccer team, my senior year had 12 Division I players, right? Like every sport was good. And I was the 5th fastest sophomore 800-meter runner. I was like, well, I'm not going to do track anymore then. I can't even make the top sophomore team. So I focused then on soccer. But I went to Fordham University, Division I college, played soccer. But even there, like when I was in college and you were a Division I athlete, you were allowed to also play and outside leagues, like outside of the season. They don't allow that anymore. But so in New York City, like the day the college soccer season ended, the next day, you know, you'd sign on for some men's league team and you'd go play a game. And so I always remember loving to play. Like no one ever had to be like, you better get to practice, or, oh, you need to go play more soccer. It was more like you need to like cut it back. And even when I played professionally, like I just loved to play, you know, I just loved to play soccer. And I did for a while. I had a few too many injuries. I had to stop when I was 26, but man, I just loved playing.
So do you think you were an anomaly?
No, I don't feel like that at all. I mean, I think I never got to a high enough level or long enough or I certainly didn't make enough money where it was my only job, you know, but it was kind of a job. But I don't ever remember being like, oh God, I'm just doing it for the money. Like that certainly wasn't ever my motivation.
Well, and that's interesting too, because when we do start making decisions that are 100% based on money, I mean, it really changes the motivations behind what we decide
in anything,
to
right?
Do.
Forget yeah. the sport. Like that's anything. Yeah.
I know. I often like to dream about a world where money doesn't exist and we can just make decisions because of other things.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's interesting, right? Like there's this, you know, there's this motivational piece as well that I think matters a lot. So I just got back. I just did a 2-week speaking tour in the Middle East, and I was in the UAE and I was in Kuwait. And what was really interesting, I was working with a bunch of international schools and, you know, Emirati citizens and Kuwaiti citizens get a stipend their whole life from the oil money. And realistically, the lack of motivation for so many of those kids to go to school, to learn, it's super high because they're like, why would I? My government's going to just pay me for whatever. So I met some kids who were really motivated and I was like, great, like that's awesome. But for the most part, they didn't really care about school. And that was sad, you know? So I think like, you know, we need some sort of carrot to be like, why do I need to work hard? Why do I do this? And maybe it's that inner drive and competitiveness, or maybe it's I got to put food on the table for my family, whatever it is. But I think if you remove all that.
You know. Well, think about it. You know, most of our listeners are not doing sports for a living
right.
at age 50-ish,
right?
You know, give or take. And right. yet we all love and include sports in our lives still. So yeah. there is that other piece where once you figure out that you still love it, you figure out how to fit it in your life.
Yeah. Well, let me say this. Like, I think this is important as a parent, right? And now I have a junior and senior in high school, right? So I'm almost done. I fly home tomorrow so I can get to my daughter's senior night soccer game, right? And it's like, for me, it's flown by. But when I think about it from my wife was a Division I athlete as well. She was a diver at Penn State. We both like, you know, sport was always, you know, something that we wanted to use to surround our kids with positive people, positive role models, good mentors, that's why we put our kids in sport, to learn lessons, how to struggle, how to suffer, how to get through it, what's good about this moment. That's why we put our kids in sports. And so, you know, 2 years ago when my daughter, who's a very good soccer player, was like, I don't think I want to play in college because I want to study abroad and I want to do all these things and I want to save the planet. I wasn't like, oh my, I wasn't devastated. I was like, that's fantastic. Because you know what? You can play soccer till you're 60. You play club sport, you play in men's league, play in a co-ed, play wherever you want. Like you can keep playing, right? And it was never the be-all and end-all of – because I work with a lot of college teams and it's really, really hard. It's 30 hours a week, right? You got to love it if you're going to spend 30 hours a week. And I see a lot of college-level athletes who don't love it anymore and it's really sad. And so – I think for everyone, you know, like if you're a part of Winter Sports Club, is your goal that my kid's an Olympian or is your goal that my kid's still skiing at 60 and 70 and taking my grandkids skiing? That's what I want, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
You know, one of the really cool things about the club is that there is that track for future Olympians. And I mean,
of course,
there's there's kids who are 7, 8 years old right now who will be in whatever snow sport they choose because we are great for those kids.
Yeah.
But there's an even greater percentage of kids who just learned the joy of floating on snow.
Right.
And, you know, our daughter will probably at some point peel off from the programs here and take all that positive, amazing skill, you know, those amazing skills that can transfer on and off the snow, right? And just become a lifelong recreational skier.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you, I didn't start skiing till I was almost 50 and we moved here.
Yeah.
And I wish I had because there is so much joy in it and it's hard to pick up when you're old. It hurts more.
Yeah, for sure. Well, like my daughter this year, right? She said, I'm going to finish high school soccer. I'm not going to play club soccer my last year because most of her team graduated last year. And she's like, because I want to do other stuff. So just the other day, she came to us and said, guess what? I just applied at Mount Bachelor. I'm going to teach skiing this year.
No. Right?
So she's going to go teach little kids skiing. Like, that was her thing. And I'm like, that's why we put you in skiing. And what was really interesting for me, right? So I'm an avid skier. I grew up in a family where no one else skied, right? This was my pursuit. And I've had passes at quite a few mountains now for the last couple of decades. And so I love it. My kids, like, there was this part of me, like, growing up in a place like Steamboat or growing up in a place like Bend where, you know, my kids did lessons, they learned to ski, and then a lot of their friends were going into ski racing or free ride or something like that. And neither of my kids wanted to do it, you know. And there was like the part of me like, oh, but if you do this, you're going to be so much better or whatever. But I was like, okay, no problem. I just want you to love going to the mountain, right? And so we'll take you up there and we have to go it. But what I also knew was that once their friends all wanted to go, then they would want to go, right? And so it was like a couple year lull, and then all of a sudden their friends started going. And now, like, every time it snows, my kids are like, Dad, can we cut school? Like, can we go skiing with you? You know? And I think that's awesome. I'm like, yeah, let's go. It's a powder day. Man, they love it.
You learn a lot more on those kind of days than you do sitting in a classroom. Mm-hmm. Would you say that there is some aspect of being a parent in that we're constantly coaching our kids? Like, we are all inherent coaches in a sense, not like hands-on on the field yelling at the kids coaches, but you know a lot about coaching. Is there any piece of being a parent that you could give some, I don't know, coaching advice to us?
Well, I think as a parent, you have to think like this. The most powerful, most impactful coaching voice that your kid will have in their life is the voice in their head, right? Telling them that they're good enough or telling them that they're not good enough, telling them that it's okay, smile, or telling them, I think you're letting mom and dad down right now. They're going to be pissed on the way home, right? That's the voice that they hear all day, every day. And the biggest influence on that voice is you, mom, and you, dad. Right. So what do you want that voice to say? That's what I think. So your actions and your words. And again, I don't think anyone listens to this podcast who doesn't love their kids. Sometimes we just love our kids in unhelpful ways. Right.
Such a great way to say it.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. You know, it's kind of the witching hour right now. I think we might need to take a little side trip down the honey stinger lane and give a little love to our podcast sponsor, local energy company, Honey Stinger. They make all kinds of amazing products for athletes, both recreational and super high performance. Right now, we are going to take a little break and try their Honey Stinger caffeinated chews. Now, parents, this is an awesome product for your midday bonk. If you have planned a bike ride like I have at 4:30 today and you know you're going to need some extra energy, dig into the chews. To be honest, they do have a three-step program for how to use their products. There's a prepare, a perform, and a recover category for each product. The chews fall into the perform category. I kind of just walk around that because I love these so much. I eat them like candy. I eat them all day long. So I personally eat them when I'm preparing, performing, and recovering. But they got some new flavors. And I wanted to also tell you, you know, with the kids, we try to stay away from caffeine until they get a little older and we can introduce it in healthy ways into their training. Their caffeinated products all have a black kind of motif on their packaging. So you will notice that. And we've got two flavors here. We've got Stingerita Lime and Cherry Cola. How is it?
Ooh, tell me about it. The Cherry Cola is so good right now. Oh, I just had one. I'm gonna tell a story too that I use these not just like in my pocket when I'm mountain biking or like before I'll go Nordic skiing or something. I coach 50 7, 8, 9 year olds And I always take some before I have to coach those kids.
Such a good idea.
Because they're nuts.
This is like our every parent's secret weapon. Mm-hmm. Ooh, and every coach's secret weapon. I love them. They're amazing. Honey Stinger, thank you so much for your support. All right, now back to the show. We're back here in caffeinated now. We're feeling good, aren't we? It's fun. You know, you can find all kinds of uses for these energy products throughout our busy lives. I always call it a work bonk. It happens between like 2 and 3:30 every day.
Yep, for sure. For sure.
Okay, so I actually want to talk a little bit here about the movement you started. You've got a website. It's called the Changing the Game Project. Mm-hmm. All right, tell us about it.
So I started this back in like 2011, 2012. And really the first thing I did was I wrote this book, Changing the Game, for parents. And it was, you know, I'd been coaching for many, many years, and I'd seen a lot of kids on the path of sport and seen kids burn out and quit. And I'd seen kids make it to the next level and turn professional. And so I felt like I had something to share with parents. And so I wrote this book, Changing the Game. And then what I realized is it's actually not that hard to write a book. It's really hard to sell a book. and so I
They're
was like,
still selling.
The publisher was like, oh, well, start a blog. So I started a blog. And what was really interesting about the blog was I love to research. And so I never just kind of wrote something. I'm like, well, what does the research say? And then I tried to make it sound pretty. And, you know, there's all this amazing sports science research and psychology and social, you know, sociology and sport. But so many of the researchers write for other researchers. And so I was like reading this and like, this would be really good for parents to know. This would be really good for coaches to know. And so that's what the blog became. And what was really interesting was then a lot of the sport governing bodies and the U.S. Olympic Committee and stuff, they started picking up on it and saying, oh, we can share this because this isn't some wackanoodle just sharing his ideas. Like, he's actually taking the research in why kids play sport or what drives enjoyment or what, you know, injuries, burnout, all this stuff. And he's making it digestible for people, and it's resonating. So, yeah, so the blog took off and led to TED Talk in 2014. But, you know, I'd been coaching for many years. So then, you know, at first I just did parent talks. I'm like, why don't I teach coaches? Like, I'm a coach. I still coach. So that was it. And the podcast was 2017. And, yeah, it's just been this crazy journey that takes me all over the world. And, I get to meet awesome people, awesome parents, awesome coaches, awesome athletes, and have cool conversations with them. And yeah, it's really fun.
So you said, you know, you at the beginning, you're like, why don't I just talk to parents? So what are you talking to them about?
Probably goes back to putting some more play and play ball, right? And yeah. So what I tell a lot of parents is understanding why kids play and why they quit. And then what's a couple things that you can do to make the experience a better one, right? How do you give them control and ownership of it? You know, one of the biggest things, like creating the right conditions and environment for them. And, you know, I'll talk to parents about, you know, like the ride home after games, right? That's what kids say is often their worst memory in sports is the ride home after. And then just,
Actually, let's dig in a little bit here. Why is that the worst experience?
Think about this, right? Like, oftentimes our kids are physically and emotionally exhausted, and we're emotionally exhausted, and yet we got them locked in a car, and we're going to make it a teachable moment. And what our kids tell us over and over is that this is maybe the least teachable moment possible, right? And every kid's different. Like, so my daughter, she gets in the car, and she's like, Dad, how did I do, right? It's her first question. That's what she wants. That question's never occurred to my son, ever. Right. What occurs to him? Where's the food? Like, what can I eat? When is food coming? Right. That's my son.
So there's an element of like read the room for us parents.
100%. So what I would say is read the room, but first of all, let your kids direct the conversation. If they bring it up, have the conversation, but read the room and look at their emotional state and your emotional state. Right. My son a couple weeks ago he's a high school varsity player. He had a really poor game, right? team had a poor game, he had a poor game. And, you know, after the game, we're home, he eats, he's like, Dad, you want to talk about the game? And I was upset, like, the way he – I just didn't think he competed very hard. And my answer was, you know what, TJ, I don't think tonight's a great night to talk about it. Like, let's just chat about tomorrow. And he's like, okay, right? And then I could bring up – be a lot more level-headed and give good advice and everything like that.
Oh, my gosh. That's so smart. You know, I remember my dad telling me the best thing you could ever do is just sleep on it.
Yeah.
Anytime 100%. There's something – if you're emotionally driven when something is happening, don't respond in the moment.
Totally. When I was a college coach, we would all – you know, that was one of the things I learned from my boss was let's not really talk about the game until we watch the video. Right? Because the video doesn't lie, right? So oftentimes you found like you thought, you know, this player had messed up, this player lost their mark and cost us the goal, whatever. And the video is like, no, that's actually not what happened, right? And so, you know, that's it. Now, when my daughter says to me in the car, you know, Dad, how do you think I did? I always ask three questions, right? Regardless if I think she was phenomenal or poor. I say, well, what went well today, right? And what needs work? What didn't go as well? And what do you think you can work on in practice this week so that next weekend's better? Same three questions, right? This really consistent. Because no matter how bad you play, something went well. And no matter how well you played, there's something to work on. And so that – I think that consistent approach doesn't make her afraid that Dad's going to fly off the handle here. Because I try not to do that. Even when I'm really upset or something like that, you know?
Yeah, you know, what's really cool is she asked you a question and you threw like the typical, you know, psychology approach of asking her questions.
Well, back. Irish people always answer questions with questions.
It's so smart, though. I mean, it's so smart because it really doesn't matter how you think she did. It matters how she thinks she did, and you get her thinking about that.
Totally. Totally, right? That's the self-awareness piece, which is the key to long-term performance is being able to honestly evaluate how did it go for yourself.
Wow, I love that. And I think that actually gives kids skills they can take into other areas of life too, because then their first, you know, response to anything that happened wouldn't necessarily be what do other people think of me having done this. It's what do I think of myself having done this. It's just awesome. Your TEDx talk, super fun. That was like a few years back now.
2014.
Oh, 2014. Wow. Yeah. Okay, cool. I love it. It's really fun and funny.
Yeah.
And entertaining. I'm going to put the link in the show notes here. So listeners, definitely watch it. You've got, gosh, maybe 500,000 views.
Yeah. It's done well. It still resonates, which is cool. What's interesting is people like, oh, wait, you're the I love watching you play guy or whatever like that. Like, hey, it's not my original idea. But like, yeah.
Oh, tell us about that then, because that stuck with me. I wanted to ask you.
So when you do a TED Talk, they say, come up with an idea worth sharing, right? That's their tagline is ideas worth sharing. And so you'll see a lot of good TED Talks and you listen to it like that was good. And then the next day, like, what did he say or what did she say, you know? And so it was funny. I was about 2 weeks out from my, you know, from the actual event. And I recorded like PowerPoint slides with my voice and I sent them to my mom who was 80 at the time. And I said, Mom, give me some feedback. And she said, John, you know, this was really interesting, but I don't know what you're talking about.
Your mom. I love her. Yeah. And you still ask her.
And I asked her and she was like, I don't know what you're talking about. And I was like, I don't have an idea worth sharing, right? And so that's when sort of I talked about why kids drop out and what we can do and all this sort of stuff. But then it kind of got down to this idea of like, you know, what do you do? What can you leave this talk doing? And it was just tell kids I love watching you play. That's it. That's how you can start. Leaving this room, start with that. And, you know, I told some stories about some personal friends who, you know, said, that's a stupid idea, John. And then like 3 months later, like, oh my God, it changed everything about my relationship with my kids. So
I mean, it's powerful.
Yeah.
And yeah, you watch it, everyone watch it. And that's the only thing you need to think of when your kids want to talk about something that, you know, could go either way. Right. Yeah. I will say, I also love your wife from your story about her. You have to share that story, right?
The ride home story. Uh-huh, yeah. Uh-huh. Okay. Sure. She doesn't like that story.
I love it because she's strong. She's awesome.
So when my son was like 5 years old, right, his first year of soccer, and, you know, I'm supposed to be this all-star coach, right? And so we go to his first practices, he plays, and then it's the first game, and the game's about to start, and he looks at me, goes, "Dad, I don't want to play." And he walks off the field. And I was like, okay, you know, whatever, other kids will play, no big deal. We go to practice that week, one practice a week, that's fine, having fun. Game two rolls around, there's a game before us, there's a bunch of tall adults yelling at kids, everyone's cheering, but this is chaos, and I can just see my son, he's very introverted. He's like, "Dad, I don't want to play." And so I was like, I was upset, right? I was angry and I was mad and I'm embarrassed because my own kid won't play. And meanwhile, he found like a, you know, cricket or a lizard or something. He's perfectly happy over there playing, whatever. And so, yeah, we get in the car afterwards and I'm putting on my seatbelt and TJ's sitting in the back and my wife's sitting next to me in the passenger seat, and I turn around and I'm like, "So TJ," and she knows exactly what I'm going to say. And she just like karate chops across the chest. And I was like, "How?" So what was that for? And she's like, "Really? Didn't you write a book about this?" And I was like, "You're right." You know, but
it shows that you're human.
You're human.
We're all human.
My kids have been in tears in the car because of things that I've said or my wife has said or whatever. And I always feel it's like vomit. You feel better and everyone else feels worse.
Oh God, you're so right. And I mean, also, you know, you got to have a lot of pressure on yourself when you are basically known as an expert in a field. And then you're expected to be perfect. Oh, let's talk about the word perfect for a minute.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, what's your take on that?
Well, you know, it's fascinating. Like in sport, right? I'm sure when you were competing, like you always want to have the perfect race, right? And yet there's no such thing as the perfect thing. And there's certainly a lot of evidence now that this pursuit of perfectionism is really, really damaging, right? Or this need to feel that. I think I've only seen one, and we can talk about the perfect tens in gymnastics or skating or whatever.
That's
a judged sport. Those are tough. The only true perfect performance I think I've ever seen is Alex Honnold's free solo of El Cap. Because if he got anything wrong, he'd be dead.
That's a really good way to put it.
So that's probably perfect right there. And what did he do? He practiced a year and a half every single day on that same thing to get it perfect, right? So mistakes are part of it. And I think failure and messing up, that's how we learn. Right? That's how we learn. And so we shouldn't ever take those learning opportunities, those learning reps away from our children in sport. Like, I think no matter how bad it goes, it's like, what's good about this today? You have a tough coach. What's good about this? You have a really tough teacher in school. Well, what's good about that? Right? Because not all your teachers and bosses and coaches are going to be good.
Yeah, that is a great way to put it. And, you know, you've been at this a decade or more. I mean, things have changed a lot in a decade. Social media.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, the way kids are pushed and pulled through trying to attain various levels of perfectionism that are shown to them that are not real through social media is got to be a topic you've hit on.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. You know, one of my former players who ended up being a Division I soccer player, and then she got a degree in counseling, and she called me the other day, cause I'm, you know, was kind of mentoring her starting a counseling business really for young athletes. And she just did a whole certification in social media trauma. And she was just telling me about this. And I'm like, oh my God, you are in a growth industry. Like, because just you see it with kids, and it's like, every picture has to be filtered, has to be edited, has to be this. What was one of the things trending for kids was be real, you know, hashtag be real, just be real, just be you. And there's so much pressure to be perfect that it's really scary and sad. And, you know, personally, like, I think the longer you can keep cell phones and social media out of your kids' hands, the better. And they'll hate you in the moment and they'll thank you for it later.
I think it's also a topic that's really hard for parents, because most parents I know are in their, you know, mid to late 30s and up. Mm-hmm. We didn't have access to this when we were their age. It didn't exist. So we parenting through it, it's all new, and we're just watching and using it from our own experience as parents, mm-hmm. or business people or whatever, you know, so we don't know what it was like to be 9 or 10 or 12. Hopefully 9-year-olds aren't on Instagram, you know, but like they do figure it out. And when they're in high school, we didn't have it. So this is a new frontier. Our kids are going to be able to parent their kids better through it, but there'll be new platforms.
Maybe something new then, yeah. Right? Like, yeah, I mean, it's really hard. It was funny when my daughter, you know, because I felt like her friends started getting phones when they were maybe 10, right? And a couple got it, and then she was like, well, why don't I get a phone? And I was like, because you don't need a phone right now. Like, we're not worried about you when you're in school. We know where you are. And, mm-hmm. You know, for some families, they have to do it. I get it, right? But for us, we didn't need to. And I just remember she says to me, well, Dad, how old were you when you got your first cell phone? I was like, 32.
Such a great answer.
And she was like, oh.
Oh, yeah. Oh. You're old.
Right. Yeah, we held out until about 14. She was like one of the last.
Oh,
and
wow.
She was actually really grateful for it at this point. She was like, you know what? That was awesome.
Oh my gosh, I love that. You know, I think the whole idea of this social media and once you put yourself out there in the public eye is that sometimes it makes you afraid to go after things, because if you fail, someone could catch that video. Someone could, you know, share to the world and broadcast that you suck, you failed. And so a lot of kids just stop. They don't want to do it. They don't even put themselves out there anymore.
You know, it's interesting. I'll talk to high school basketball coaches or, you know, college basketball coaches, and they're like, no one wants to play defense because they don't want to get dunked on. And then it's on ESPN top 10 of someone throwing down a dunk in their face. And so they'll just get out of the way and let them score, right? Not because they can't play defense, because they don't want to be a national embarrassment or whatever. And so, yeah, I mean, it's a real thing right now. And, you know, I highly recommend every parent, whether you like soccer or not, to watch the new David Beckham documentary. Mm. It's absolutely phenomenal. It's on Netflix.
Cool.
If you just want to understand mentality at the highest level of sport and what some people suffer through, and David Beckham, I mean, that guy suffered. He was hated by an entire country. Spit on sidewalks, people threatening to kidnap his kids because he made a mistake in a World Cup game, right? It's a crazy – but I mean, I'm so impressed by David Beckham.
Wow. Wow. Yeah, I want to – I wouldn't mind watching
that.
Yeah,
you should. It's so good. So good.
So good. Okay, so you've been at this, like we mentioned, for a while. You did your talk almost 10 years ago. Has your message evolved as the world is evolving, or is it pretty much still the same?
Yes, it's evolved. There's definitely nuance to it, right? And the science changes and the research changes. You know, when I wrote the book Changing the Game, I did a sort of a whole chapter on long-term athlete development and stuff like that. And sort of the idea of LTAD has certainly gotten a lot more nuance to it, right? That it's not this structured linear pathway, but it's just kind of a guide. And there's a psychosocial element to it that's more blended in. The other sort of nuance is, instead of saying, I think every kid needs to be a multi-sport athlete, the world doesn't really allow that for everyone anymore, right? The costs, the commitments, you have multiple kids in sport. We can't drag three kids to three sports a year, or whatever, because the sports ask a lot. So my nuance now is every kid needs, if you're not going to get a multi-sport experience, you need a multi-movement experience. You have to learn how to move like an athlete. And the younger you do that, the better off you'll be. And, you know, and people say, well, my kid only loves soccer. And I'm like, yeah, but you know what? When your 8-year-old only loves pizza, you don't just say, well, forget your vegetables. You say, as the adult in the room, I know you need to eat vegetables. So you can't just have pizza every night. And I think this is what we have to say in sport. I know you love soccer. That's great. But try Taekwondo. Try a martial art. You know, try yoga. You know, get in some sort of movement thing where you're doing, you're layering something else. And they don't all have to be club sports or team sports. I mean, you live in a place like Steamboat, awesome. Bike, ski, trampoline, whatever you do, hike, do something else outside of your sport, and you will be much better off in the long run.
Really great advice. I love it. My gosh, I think we're going to be winding down here because I think you've got another talk today. Do you have another talk?
I do. One more talk to the parents tonight. So I did a couple-hour workshop with the full-time staff yesterday morning and then brought in kind of the part-time staff yesterday evening. And then tonight, a parents talk just in the community here.
Well, you are a gift. You're giving parents and kids a gift, you know, even with your last piece of advice, which was learn how to move and just keep moving in all the directions and all the ways, you know, it's not just forward and back and side to side. It's up and down and every way you can. You're giving people the gift of learning about their bodies and mm-hmm. being in touch with themselves. Mm-hmm. And people who aren't in touch with their own bodies, they miss stuff, mm-hmm. you know, it is such a gift. So I love that. You know, we wrap the podcast with asking every guest the same question. Uh-oh. All right, get ready for it. It's a doozy. So, John O'Sullivan, what is the greatest lesson you've learned through sport?
I would say that the greatest lesson that I've learned through sport 100% has to be probably gratitude. Like gratitude for great coaches and mentors I've had, gratitude for my health. I had a lot of injuries, like playing soccer and then since then biking and skiing and but I remember very distinctly set when I was 17 years old, I had a double leg fracture playing soccer. And I was feeling really sorry for myself. And I went to my first rehab session to learn to walk on crutches with this full leg cast and then saw someone there paralyzed from the waist down and thought to myself, and in a couple months, I'll be better, right? And that's their life story, you know? And so I think gratitude is something that, you know, there's always some good in everything that happens to you. And if you can find the good, if we can teach our kids to find the good, sport's a pretty powerful thing for sure.
Well, that is awesome. Way to wrap it. Thank you so much. Can't wait to see her next year. I hope you come every year for decades to come.
I love it here. Yeah.
Enjoy your time outdoors and connecting with lovely Steamboat. Thanks again, John.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to the Steamboat Springs Winter Sports Club Show presented by Honey Stinger. Check out the club's winter and summer programs at sswsc.org. If you have a special topic or guest you want featured, we'd love to hear from you. Now get out there and support, lead, or be a champion on or off the mountain.